Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu converted the inhabitants of South India. These people were as strong as elephants, but they were in the clutches of the crocodiles of various philosophies, such as the Buddhist, Jain and Mayavadi philosophies. With His disc of mercy, the Lord delivered them all by converting them into Vaishnavas, devotees of the Lord. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's converting the people of South India into Vaishnavas is compared herein to Lord Vishnu's delivering Gajendra, the elephant, from the attack of a crocodile. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu visited southern India, almost all the residents were within the jaws of the crocodiles of Buddhist, Jain and Mayavad philosophies. Here Kaviraj Goswami states that although these people were as strong as elephants, they were almost in the clutches of death because they were being attacked by the crocodiles of various philosophies. However, just as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the form of Vishnu saved the elephant Gajendra from the clutches of a crocodile, so He saved all the people of South India from the clutches of various philosophies by converting them into Vaishnavas. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Krupasandhu Bhyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. I'm grateful to be here. All of you at the lotus feet of their lordships, and try to speak something today on the topic of the way in which Krishna's Kaviraj Goswami reveals the glory of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In this section, it's in terms of his outreach. So how Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has structured the Chaitanya Charitamrit to reveal Mahaprabhu's glories, Mahaprabhu's glorious outreach specifically. So that will be the broad topic I'll discuss. So this verse specifically is saying, this is a prelude to the description of how Mahaprabhu will travel extensively in South India and deliver people. So I'll use the tablet as a whiteboard to write certain things. So here, if you consider the Chaitanya Charitamrita, doesn't even know how many sections it has. 3 sections. Now, if we consider we are in right now the section, this is the Adi. Now, Adi has 1 to 19 chapters. Madhya has, so it's 1 to 25 chapters. And the Antya has 20 chapters. So is it 19 or 17 the first? Anyway, whatever it is, sorry about that. But let's focus on the Madhya, that's our focus right now. So now here what is happening essentially is, we are at the transition of the 8th and the 9th chapter. If we look at the overall book, it's a very intriguing picture. See, chapters 1 to 4, I could say till 5, is Mahaprabhu's travel from Bengal. Specifically, he took sannyas in Bengal, and from Bengal to Odisha, he specifically came to Puri. That is his travel that is described. Then 6th chapter is his discussion with Sarvabhaum Bhattacharya. It's a long discussion. And then after that, we will see that immediately he leaves. He leaves immediately on traveling. And in fact, we'll see later on in the 10th, 11th chapters, when he comes back, at that time Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya introduces Mahaprabhu or introduces to Mahaprabhu various prominent residents of Puri. So it's interesting that like Mahaprabhu has attained an extraordinary success. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is the leading scholar of a whole branch of philosophy, Navanyaya. And then he's also the main advisor of the king over there. So Mahaprabhu has transformed him. But Mahaprabhu does not rest on his laurels. Like he does that and immediately departs. So he, at least soon after taking sannyas, he is in a very exuberant mood. So he wants to keep traveling. And we will see, Mahaprabhu has, if you consider his travels, there are two main travels he has. Which are the two main travels? Yeah. So south and north. And it's interesting that for him, his travels to the north actually take more time. In the sense that not that it is a longer duration, the exact duration of each tour is not, like in terms of days, it's not specified so clearly in Chaitanya Charitamrita. But the idea is, Mahaprabhu's associates are afraid for him to go to Vrindavan. Why? Because Vrindavan, if he goes, yad gatva na nivartante. He is so much in love with Vrindavan, he may never come back. In fact, that was also one of the apprehensions of his mother. Externally, mother said that, Chichimata said, if you go to Vrindavan, it's so far away, I'll not get any news. But another was, if he goes to Vrindavan, he may just lose himself completely over there. So, sometimes devotees on there, T-shirt or something, they put, I lost my heart in Vrindavan. You know? Well, if you lost your heart, you gained something wonderful. But maybe we don't want you to lose your heart so early. You know, there is so much service to it in all over the world. Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. Prabhupada left Vrindavan to go all over the world. In fact, you can say that's the external vision. Prabhupada didn't leave Vrindavan. Prabhupada carried Vrindavan with him wherever he went. And he manifested Vrindavan over there. But the point is that initially he's eager to travel, and even before many of his associates have assembled there, he just leaves for South India. And then later he comes back, and when he has to go to North India, he has to repeatedly request his associates, and associates come up with excuses. Oh, this festival is here, go after this festival, and then that festival is there, and go after that festival. So it takes a lot of effort for Mahaprabhu to actually go to North India, and specifically to Vrindavan. But South India he leaves immediately. And so his South India tour is basically described from, if we consider 7, 8, 9, 10, and approximately 11, he's fully back. 10 is more or less like his return. And in this, his travels are described in chapter 7 and also in chapter 9. These are two chapters. And in between here is the meeting. With whom is that meeting? Ramanandrai. And that's an elaborate meeting. So, the way Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has structured the Chaitanya Charitamrita is significantly different from all the other biographies of Mahaprabhu. If we consider Mahaprabhu biographies, they broadly fall in two genres. So, generally when we talk about biography, biography is a book which describes the life of a person. So normally, most such books are narratives. They are narrative in their nature. Okay, this happened and this happened, this happened. They focus on incidents. And this is what Chaitanya Bhagavat is, Chaitanya Mangal is, and most of the biographies. When Mahaprabhu departed, he was such a celebrity that at that time writing books was not easy. Now anybody can just type on a computer and publish with Kindle. At that time, writing was very laborious. Of course, writing requires effort many times. But that time, it's very laborious. But 27 biographies of Mahaprabhu were written. And that gives us some idea of the impact that he had. It is a colossal impact. And in general, one of the reasons why a biography is written is that the author cannot tolerate the thought that the memory of the deceased person will become deceased with that person. So I want the memory to live on. And that's why they write biographies. So we can see that Mahaprabhu had such an impact. Now, among those, 9 are presently available. And 3 are what are primarily emphasized. So Chaitanya Charitamrita is the 3rd. And in fact, among all the biographies that were written, this biography was the last. And after this biography, actually, no more biographies were written. So Chaitanya Charitamrita was the last biography. And in this, actually, the focus is not so much on narration as on analysis. Or it's more of a book of theology in the mode of a biography. That's why what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami does is that he's describing incidents, and when there are significant discussions, then those chapters become extremely long. Extremely long. So if you will see all the longest chapters. Now, some of the chapters incidents are also long, but there are many incidents described. But the longest chapters are the 6th chapter, the 8th chapter in Madhya Leela. And these two are elaborate conversations. Sarvamattacharya conversation, then Ramananda Rai conversation. And then after that, if we'll go towards the end of this, we'll have the 19th, 20th, 21st till 25. All of these are more or less teachings. They're instructions to Rupana. So this is with Sarvamattacharya, this is with Ramananda Rai, and these are with Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami. So what is he doing over here? He is telling that what is his purpose. So what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami did was, he, for him, the biography was not just a means to tell the life story of Mahaprabhu. The biography was also a means to consolidate his life teachings. Because among various spiritual teachers, at least in the medieval history, Mahaprabhu is among the few or the rare who didn't himself write extensively his will. So what were his teachings? So that was consolidated by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. So in one sense, what happened was, after Mahaprabhu departed, his legacy, the legacy of Mahaprabhu was there primarily in 3 places. One was Vrindavan, and the other was Bengal. The 3rd was Orissa. And here, the legacy in each of these places was kept in significantly different ways. That in Bengal, it was mostly his childhood pastimes, his youth pastimes. It is mostly his Leela. And it is more his early Leela. And here it was more of his later Leela. And that stayed in the collective memory. So all the biographies that have been written mostly by devotees in Bengal, not so much by devotees in Orissa. And then the devotees in Vrindavan, what happened was, for all of them, they were mainly the Goswamis. And Mahaprabhu appeared in Bengal, and most of his followers initially were from Bengal. But when they went to Vrindavan, they didn't focus on writing in Bengali, because not many people knew Bengali over there. So all of this was written in Bengali or Odia, mostly Bengali. He said that actually what happened soon after Mahaprabhu departed, Pratap Rudra also lost the will to live. And he also departed. And then the legacy that was prominent in Puri shifted more to Bengal. And then it continued on. So in Vrindavan, because it was a place of Sanskritized learning, the focus was more on writing in Sanskrit. And the focus was also more on writing not Leela but Tattva. Because when Mahaprabhu came to Vrindavan, it was a sensation. But he was there just for 2 months and he left after that. So when the Goswamis were writing, they were writing for the influential intellectual circles on those places. So they all acknowledge the glory of Mahaprabhu as their teacher, as their Lord. But beyond that, they don't focus on Mahaprabhu. So they are not writing the biographies of Mahaprabhu. They are writing the teachings of Mahaprabhu. So their writing center more on Krishna. They're describing in Vrindavan. So describe Krishna Leela. They describe the philosophy of Gaura Shiksha. So Shatsandarbhas and books like that, Bhaktirasamrit, Sindhu, all of them are written. So now what happened was, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is in a slightly older generation. When he comes, he actually was born in Bengal and then he went to Vrindavan. And then when he wrote Chaitanya Charitamrit, that is the first biography which is a combination of Leela and Tattva. So the Leela he had heard from his childhood. The Tattva he learned when he went to Vrindavan and the instruction of Nityanand Prabhu and learned from the Goswamis. And there, when he wrote the book, he describes the pastimes. But some of the pastimes are described more in detail in Chaitanya Bhagavat. And Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami does not repeat those pastimes too much. It's beautiful whatever pastimes are described. But his focus clearly is on the Tattva. And that is what he primarily elaborates. In general, we can understand the focus of an author by evaluating what are they spending time on? How much text is devoted to what? So Chaitanya Charitamrita systematized Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings in the form of a biography. So now what happened was, because it's a biography, it is relatively easy to read. And those who want philosophy, they can go deep into the philosophy. Those who don't want, they'll just read the pastimes. But the philosophy is very much there within it and prominently there. And this integration, the way he has done it, also reveals how Mahaprabhu is presenting. So this is the overall structure. And that's why when you see over here, the time when he's writing, he is, the other biographies don't have so many Sanskrit verses that are composed. Chaitanya Bhagavat and Chaitanya Mangal, they may sometimes quote Sanskrit verses as a part of their description of the activities of Mahaprabhu. So somebody quoted this verse, or this verse is appropriate over here. But Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami quotes extensively from the Bhagavatam, so that is Sanskrit verses. But also he composes original Sanskrit verses, especially at the start of each chapter, which summarize that chapter. So basically, and Srila Prabhupada also follows in that itself, from Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami to Srila Prabhupada, actually this became like a tradition. So the tradition is Sanskrit in Bengali. So Prabhupada, for example, composes the Markine Bhagavad Dharma. That's a song which he composed when he is on the verge of entering America, beholding the coastline of America. And that time we see that there are Bengali verses, but in between there are Sanskrit verses. So it's a song, but within the song he's quoting Sanskrit scripture. So that seamless transition between Sanskrit and Bengali, that was pioneered by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. And one reason contextually is that he brought together the Sanskrit teachings of Tattva and the Bengali description of the pastimes together in one magnum opus. And this became such an authoritative book that afterwards, nobody felt any need to write any more biographies of Mahaprabhu. In fact, it became like the base book on which the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition would elaborate its teachings. So that's what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is going. So we'll see the previous chapter was extremely long. The narrative pastimes are, the narrative chapters which narrate pastimes are generally not that long. He describes the incidents briefly. And this also reflects another point. So I'll make three points. The first was the structure of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the combination of Tattva and Leela. Second is, this reveals the two aspects of outreach. Two forms of outreach. Generally we use the word class and mass. That's something similar over here. So Mahaprabhu's class outreach and his mass outreach. So his class outreach is to intellectuals, to the leaders of society. And at that time, because although there was a political rule in India of Islam, there was within the broad Vedic society, Hindu society, the Brahmins still had significant influence. They were the intellectual leaders. and Mahaprabhu interacted with them and how he transformed them. So here we will see in his mass outreach, when he's doing that, it just describes how he chants and dances and sings. And the result of that is people are just transformed, magically transformed. And then he's spending a lot of time. So for example, Sarvam Bhattacharya, he spends day upon day. And not that so much he's talking as he's hearing. And then appropriately he speaks. With Ramananda Rai also, it is, he's not speaking, he's hearing. He's directing the conversation through his questions. But he's not speaking primarily. He's having those discussions. And we will see that if you consider the legacy of Mahaprabhu, Mahaprabhu went to North India, he went to South India. And when he went, there was an enormous impact. However, after he went and he left, again, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, when he went to South India, he said that Mahaprabhu had brought South India to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. But now again, South India has relapsed into its previous ways. So the sustained legacy. So the sustained legacy happened where Mahaprabhu actually did class outreach. And it was as follows. So Ramananda Rai, whom he met, now he will renounce the world and not exactly renounce the world. He's still a grahastha, but he renounces his worldly position in the political world. And he comes to be with Mahaprabhu in Puri. So that legacy primarily happens through his class outreach. The Goswamis, they write books. They systematize the Gaudiya Siddhanta. And then they carry it on. So that is the way Mahaprabhu does a class outreach. And Srila Prabhupada also wanted this. He wanted this in the terms that wherever he would travel, initially he would meet people and he would give classes and he would do kirtans. But in the later years, as our movement started becoming more influential, Prabhupada looked forward to meeting influential people. Wherever he would go, the leaders of society, and we have Prabhupada's conversations with some prominent thinkers. And Prabhupada loved these kind of discussions. He also wanted this to be a significant part of the outreach. So we will talk about, so the previous chapter described Mahaprabhu's class outreach. And now it says mass outreach is going to be described in this chapter. And here a metaphor is used. See, generally the purpose of a metaphor, whenever we use a metaphor basically is a comparing something which we want to tell with something else. So the purpose of a metaphor is essentially to link the unfamiliar with the familiar. So you want to link the unfamiliar with the familiar. So generally the concept may be unfamiliar. The concept is unfamiliar. But the metaphor, the analogy, that the compared object we can see. So the compared object is familiar. And that way, the metaphor makes the concept accessible. So generally, what metaphors are used also conveys the target audience. Say, if somebody is giving a spiritual talk, and if you hear them, say, giving examples from, say, Bollywood or Hollywood or cricket or tennis or this, then we may wonder, okay, what kind of audience? This is probably not a temple hall audience that they're speaking to, isn't it? So, or if somebody starts using quite scientific metaphors. Oh, really? Okay. Or some medical metaphors. So the metaphors, they reveal the kind of audience that is being addressed. In the past, generally books were written by scholars for scholars. Books, the spiritual wisdom generally was passed primarily through the oral tradition. Because there would be wise people in most places and they would speak. Books were not so easily available. So books were written by scholars for scholars. And we see the fact that the metaphor that he's using, it's indicating that he expects his audience to be already familiar with the Bhagavatam. So at first glance, you say, okay, Buddhist philosophy, Jain philosophy, these are known to be non-violent philosophies. And then why are they being compared to a crocodile over here?
You know,
generally a different animals are said to symbolize different things. You know, generally if we say in any culture, you know, he is like a crocodile, that's not a very complimentary thing to say, isn't it? It conveys strength, but it also conveys fear. It also conveys a certain level of danger, harshness. So the idea is that the point is not so much to demonize the philosophy. The point is to compare. So just as Gajendra was trapped. So just as Gajendra was trapped, Gajendra was powerful like a crocodile, but he was trapped. And similarly, what happened was that here it is said these people were strong, but they were trapped. They were trapped. Now, what does strength refer to here? Actually, in India, especially in the southern part, the spiritual culture was largely preserved. So, if you see, when India had like almost 1,000 years of Islamic invasion, and there was a lot of devastation in North India. And the North Indian culture that is there right now in India, that is quite syncretic. No, it's a combination of the traditional Vedic culture and the culture that came from the various Islamic invaders. There were not just one, there were many who invaded at different times. South India was relatively unaffected. Although there were some invasions, but it was never really, the whole part was not really conquered and dominated. Some part was, but not as much. The devastation was not that much, that frequently. So, the overall spiritual culture was quite strong. And in that sense, when you talk about Bauddha, Jaina, Mayavadi, none of these are materialistic philosophies. We could say they are not exactly devotional philosophies. They are, Buddhism and Jainism, they are more non-theistic. They are not so much atheistic as non-theistic. Although there are some expressions which did become atheistic eventually. But they just didn't focus on God so much. And from some became atheistic. But from our tradition's perspective, they are actually pre-theistic. That means they laid the ground for eventually theism and eventually bhakti to be presented once again. So, there are various reasons and there are various ways Mahaprabhu's strategies affected. So, I'll focus on the class outreach, but just let me complete this part about this metaphor. So, what is being talked about over here is that people were attacked by these philosophies. And Bauddha Jaina Mayavadi Kutarka Khandana. So, it is in the Bhaktivinoda Thakur has composed 108 names of Mahaprabhu. In one of them, he described that these were the same thing. These three philosophies, they were what Mahaprabhu, he refuted. He freed people from these philosophies. Now, as I said, all these three philosophies, they are, we could say, nowadays people have the spiritual but not religious. So, these were spiritual but not theistic. Not exactly theistic. So, spiritual means that they were focusing on something higher. They're focusing on some higher reality, some conception of liberation, some conception of nirvana, some conception of some higher attainment beyond the material. So they're spiritual in the sense that they were non-materialistic. But they were not focused on God. So it's an interesting combination. And so for people who are relatively speaking sattva-guna, those who have relatively the pious culture. So, philosophies that are rajasic or tamasic, they are not going to attract people so much. Now, I'm here talking in terms of the overall impact, because in every philosophy, there'll be practitioners of various kinds. But these all focus on some level of higher consciousness. But what happens sometimes is, especially the emphasis of Chaitanya Charitamrita is, and generally of the Gaudiya tradition, is something quite specific. You know, we have sattva, goodness, rajas, tamas. And then above this, we have shuddha sattva. Now, this idea that there is transcendental beyond the goodness, that is there in the Vedic script, various texts, but is emphasized in the, especially in the Bhagavatam, the term shuddha sattva. So what happens is, most of the focus of the Gaudiya tradition has been on raising people from sattva to shuddha sattva. And that is why, if you read Chaitanya Charitamrita or Chaitanya Mangal, when it's described that, oh, the society was so degraded. Now, what is their idea of society being degraded? They're saying that, oh, people would bathe in the Ganga, but they would chant the holy names only at the time of the eclipses. Or they would speak the Bhagavatam, they would speak on the Bhagavatam, but there would be no mention of bhakti. Now, today's world, we say, is that degraded?
Well, if somebody is bathing in the Ganga, somebody is actually reciting Bhagavatam, well, that's quite elevated, isn't it? But the point is that from the perspective of Chaitanya Charitamrita, sattva is often the greatest competitor to shuddha sattva. And therefore, sattva, anything that is in somewhat in sattva also, is an entrapment. So Buddhism, Jainism and Mayavad, we could say that in terms of their philosophical implications, that the idea there is no ultimate reality at all, that could be, somebody could say that's tamasic. But in terms of their lifestyle that they recommended, that was relatively sattvic. Some amount of regulation, some amount of higher pursuits. So sattva, in one sense, can be good for somebody who is in rajas, tamas and rajas. We bring them to sattva, that is good. They'll be able to rise to shuddha sattva. But our tradition's focus, at least at that time, has been on raising people from sattva to shuddha sattva. And thus, when it is said that there's a crocodile, the point is not to demonize the philosophy. The point is to recognize that sattva can also become a trap. And if somebody is trapped by sattva, they cannot rise to shuddha sattva. So what Mahaprabhu did was, he is compared that his instructions, his example, his very presence, all of those acted like the Sudarshan Chakra. And what was holding people down at sattva, it was cut off and they all rose towards shuddha sattva. That's what is described in this particular metaphor. Now, how does Mahaprabhu go about doing the class outreach? So I'll talk about three things and I'll conclude with that. So it is A-R-T. See, the first thing is that there has to be a significant difference between the way mass outreach is done and class outreach is done. Generally, with mass outreach, what happens is, say, this is the authority, this is the teaching figure, and this is the subordinate. So it's quite hierarchical. So Mahaprabhu would tell people to chant, and they would just be so inspired, and they would chant. But then, that's with respect to the mass outreach. But with respect to class, what happens is, when Mahaprabhu is chanting, now if he will tell Sarvam Bhatta, he will tell Prakashananda Saraswati to chant. Prakashananda Saraswati is not going to chant. In fact, he's going to say, you chanters, you're simply sentimental people. You know, it's not that I will chant, rather you should stop chanting and do what I'm doing. So he says, you should stop being sentimental and you should start discussing Vedanta with me. So what happens is, in one sense, when we are doing class outreach. So what happens? Now, we may be authority in a particular field. And say, we could be in the field of spirituality or bhakti or whatever. We are authority. But when we are doing class outreach, then others are also authorities in their particular field. Whatever their field may be. Their field may be science. Their field may be some management. Their field may be philosophy. So in this case, we cannot speak down to them. It is more of a discussion rather than a discourse. And that is a very different dynamic. So Srila Prabhupada, when he had started his Bhaktivedanta Institute, he wrote a letter to the devotees about how they should do outreach. And he says three things. So this acronym ART, which I took, was Prabhupada says that we should learn the art of how to approach these influential people. I'm paraphrasing the quote now. And he says, they will be proud, but that's all right. They have earned it. It's very striking. He said, it's all right, they have earned it. That means if they have attained some success in their particular field, that they will be proud. That's okay. They are at a high level. So he says, so he says, we have to learn the art. Not that we have to teach them. We have to learn the art of how to connect with them, how to communicate with them. And then he says, we need to appreciate different points of view. Not that, okay, this is right and this is wrong. Okay, they are coming from a particular perspective. Says, we need to learn to appreciate different points of view. So they, from their experience, so appreciate the viewpoint. This appreciate doesn't mean agree. There's a different point. Appreciating is, yeah, okay, I understand where you're coming from. And based on your perspective, your life experience, your analysis, yeah, it's not a unreasonable conclusion. Just because it is not unreasonable doesn't mean that it is not incorrect. It may be incorrect, but we appreciate different perspectives. And then, second is respect. Respect their achievement. Respect their position. We see this in Mahaprabhu's dealings. I don't have time to go into this elaborately. But we see this in Mahaprabhu's dealings with Sarvam Bhattacharya, even with Prakashananda Saraswati. With Sarvam Bhattacharya, Mahaprabhu treats him like a father and a teacher. In fact, his disciples are upset. Why are you doing like this? But why is he treating like an ordinary person? Mahaprabhu says, no, he is my well-wisher. Mahaprabhu hears from him. And the third is time. We need to give them time to arrive at their understanding. So sometimes, okay, I told you this. Why don't you understand this? Why don't you accept it? No, it doesn't work like that. People need to figure things out. Okay, what's going on over here? Yeah, I heard this and I heard this and I heard this. It takes time. So if we have this mood of wanting to immediately convert, that doesn't work. It's not that we give one talk and yes, sarva dharman parityajya. I forget everything else and surrender. That doesn't happen. People, they have their own conceptions. We may say they are misconceptions, but they have their conceptions and they have to deal with it. Okay, this is what I have learned till now and this is what I am learning now. And how does all this fit together? So it takes time. But if we go through this, we as a movement have been successful to a large extent in direct outreach to the masses. Of course, there's a lot more to do in every area. But where actually, if we want to reach influential people, then we need to redefine or at least reorient the way we present. And we will see that Mahaprabhu himself has provided the example. So, appreciating others' points of view. So, when he's, what is appreciation? Just in the past, in Sarvam Bhattacharya says, yeah, I can understand where he's coming from. It might seem a little presumptuous that a grahastha wants to instruct a sannyasi. But it's not. He says, actually, he's my well-wisher. He sees that I'm a young sannyasi and therefore, to protect me, he's speaking the philosophy. And then he sits down and hears respect. He constantly, even as I said, his disciples, his followers are annoyed. But Mahaprabhu says, don't be annoyed with him. Don't speak like this about him. And then time, it goes on for 7 days. He just hears. Now we could say it is quite likely for Mahaprabhu those 7 days would have been intellectual torture. He said, just hearing philosophy. See, there are three things. Sometimes when we don't understand something, we get bored. And that's bad enough. We get bored, we get exhausted. Generally, as a speaker, you can understand when people are not connecting is when people start looking at you as if they are watching a foreign language movie without subtitles. So, one is that we don't understand, then it's annoying. It's okay. But other is that, second level is that we understand that this person is speaking something wrong. But we can't figure out what exactly is wrong and how exactly to point out it is wrong. Sometimes some speakers make some point which makes us uncomfortable. But, you know, what exactly is wrong? How to point it out? So we are uncomfortable. Third is where we know what the speaker is speaking is wrong, and we know how it is wrong, how to explain it. And at that time, to maintain restraint is actually extremely difficult. You know, you are wrong, immediately I'll point it out. So the time means Mahaprabhu exhibits this restraint. That he knows what he's speaking is wrong, he knows how to point it out, but he waits, he bides his time. And that's how he's able to eventually, when he respects Sarvabhauma, Sarvabhauma respects him. And then when Mahaprabhu speaks, Sarvabhauma listens to him. And thus he's able to transform. So this is how we also can, especially as our movement is spreading, you know, more and more, we need to reach out to people who are leaders or who are potential leaders. If we have to spread in a sustainable and extensive way. So there are some pointers from Mahaprabhu's example as depicted by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. So I'll summarize. I spoke three main points. The first point was the structure of Chaitanya Charitamrita, how it is a combination of tattva, that is from the Goswamis in Vrindavan in Sanskrit, and Leela, that is from the Bengali Vaishnavas in Bengali. So it's the last biography, and it is more a book of theology in the mode of a biography. And the second point was about Mahaprabhu's outreach, how he did both class plus mass outreach. And both are being described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So it is that when he is doing class outreach, he's actually spending time, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami also spends time in describing this. So what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is doing, so that is indicated by the metaphor that he uses. That actually, when he's comparing the Buddhists and other philosophies to crocodile, the point is, it is to an informed audience who knows that they also are familiar with the Bhagavatam. And that indicates so this outreach was primarily, both of them were largely for taking people from sattva to shuddha sattva. And in that sense, sattva is also considered to be a trap, so it's compared to a crocodile over here. And the last part was about class outreach. I talked about three things. That is, appreciate their point of view. Appreciate doesn't mean agree, but just say that it's reasonable that you come to this conclusion from your perspective. Then respect their position, that they are not be subordinates because they are expert in their position. And give them time to arrive at conclusions. So if we do this, we can also expand our outreach to more influential and intellectual circles and follow in Mahaprabhu's footsteps in a small way in doing both class and mass outreach. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Do we have time for questions? Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah. Till 9 o'clock. Okay. Sure. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much, Prabhuji, for such a wonderful class. And I was thinking about this acronym to appreciate, respect, and give time or allow time for the transformation to happen. And I was thinking that, yes, sometimes we do come across very influential people whom we would like to present Krishna consciousness to. I was also thinking there are times as well that with our own family members, that perhaps we're also wondering how do we present Krishna consciousness to them. And I was wondering if we could use the same system, or is there something else that you would suggest to... Because oftentimes, you know, they may say something and we think, no, this is wrong, and we want to sort of correct them. But like you said, do we have that position to do so? So I was wondering if you could say something.
Okay, yeah. So if we are to try to share Krishna Bhakti with our family members, how do we do that? Yeah, we have our material relationship and it has its dynamics. And then we try to spiritualize the relationship that brings its own dynamics. So sometimes it becomes too dynamic. It becomes, then what is happening in that relationship, it's difficult to figure out. So, yes, these broad three principles can apply to any form of outreach. But let's put it this way. See, if this is Krishna. In fact, I'll be doing a seminar on this topic eventually. But this one diagram is, this is Krishna. This is, say, this is V. And say, this is our relative, our family member. So what happens is, say, we could say, this is one. This is our most important relationship with Krishna. And this is two, our relationship with a family member. And the three is their relationship with Krishna. So the ideal situation is where all three grow together. Srila Prabhupada said one of the purposes of ISKCON is that to bring everyone closer to each other and closer to the prime entity Krishna. That means one, two and three, all the three relationships grow together. That's the best. But among these, now when I put one, two, three, it's both in the sense of importance and in the sense of control. Now, we have the maximum control on our relationship with Krishna. And we have the least control on anyone else's relationship with Krishna. Now, what happens is that the normal tendency of the attached mind, now the mind can be attached to worldly things, the mind can be attached to even spiritual things, and especially to try to give spirituality to others. So sometimes we get frustrated because we put in maximum effort where we have the least control. And we put least effort where we have maximum control. So we put too much time in three and we put a lot of time and very little in one. And so we are preaching to the other person, do this, don't do this. And they say, you know, after you became a devotee, you know, you have become a more unpleasant person to be with. So, is our devotion, we say bhakti, theoretically bhakti manifests, leads to the manifestation of all good qualities. But is that actually happening? So, in general, if the other person is not really very interested, they don't seem to be so eager, then it's best to see all these three as separate relationships. It means give time for one, and do whatever is required for a healthy two. It's whatever is normal in that relationship, do that. And then leave three to Krishna. So, leave three to Krishna because what happens is, if we put too much pressure on three, that you should connect with Krishna, then what happens is, if we put too much, say, pressure here, then that creates a strain here. Because what is happening is, we are demand every relationship, there is a contribution that we are doing to the other person and there's an expectation from the other person. So when we are expecting too much, on one side, you know, you should do this, you should not do this, we're expecting all that. And then when that person wants time, no, I have to go to temple for the program, I have to chant. So what happens is if our expectation increases and our contribution in the relationship decreases, then that creates a strain. And when there is a strain in a close relationship, then that actually creates weakness in this also. Because how much can you, if there's tension at the home, even if you sit down to chant, how much can you focus on Krishna? Can't really do that much. So, what we want to chant to make our temple, our home into a temple. We don't want to chant as a means to mentally run away from our home. You know, my home is so much tension, I just want to forget it all. That's not the purpose of chanting. So what happens if that is happening? Just decrease the pressure on three. Let that person grow at their pace. And do what is required in two. And make sure that we have our space for one. One is our relationship with Krishna. And in general, we'll find that, especially in today's world, which is relatively not so hierarchical or so vertical. If we don't impose on the other person will also not impose on us. So if we don't force three, they won't interfere with one. So then what will happen is we can pursue our relationship with Krishna and then do what is required in our relationship with that person. And then, so as we keep doing that, over a period of time, if we are practicing bhakti, that will lead to positive transformation within us. You know, we'll become more understanding, we'll become more tolerant, we'll become more helpful. And when they see that, then they'll feel, hey, this is... This bhakti has made you a better person. This bhakti has made you a better husband, a better son, a better parent, a better sibling, whatever it is. Then they'll say, okay, let me explore this bhakti also. So in general, for them, it's very difficult for them to connect through us, because our relationship dynamic comes in as an additional factor. So that's the broad answer. Okay. Thank you. Yes, we had a lot of questions. Yeah. Okay, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for your teaching. I'm a bit nervous about this question. I was going to ask you this last night, but your diagram there is quite pertinent to my concern. Because you have Krishna, you've got we or the followers, and a relative that may not be attached to Krishna. Now my question is, if the relative, I'm doing this metaphorically, if the relative is the Buddha, okay,
yes,
and the Buddha, as far as I understand it, did not necessarily believe in a higher Krishna, but he did believe in what, say, Thich Nhat Hanh would call interbeing, and the interrelationship of everything in the cosmos with ourselves, and the idea that we do not have a separate self, and that also means that we're full of non-self elements, like the sun and the rain, then in that context, I would have thought the teaching of the Buddha would be as high as anything else, whether or not he believes in God. So I don't know whether I've made myself clear, but if I have a little bit, then I would be very respectful and like to hear your answer. Thank
so you. Let me paraphrase what I understood of the question. So what you're saying is that if somebody is connected with a spiritual path where they don't accept Krishna as a personal ultimate reality, but they do talk about the ultimate interconnectedness of everything, and there's no idea of the self, but ultimately all of existence is interconnected. So would that also be a high level of spiritual understanding? Is that the question broadly? Yeah, thank you. So in general, whenever we talk about any path, see, that path has many aspects to it. So in the path, there could be their philosophy. Then there could be their culture. Then there could be their social activities. What do they do practically? Then there could be other aspects, everything. So there could be their personal relationships and so many things like that. Then there could be their practical resources, their infrastructure, or their environment, their ethos, practically. So when somebody is following a particular path, what are they actually connecting with? Say, for example, somebody may say, this person is a Buddhist or this person is a Mayavadi. Okay, they are a member of this organization. Well, maybe, but is it that philosophical element is what has primarily attracted them? Or is it, they just like the environment over there, they want their children to get something spiritual, they want to have a place where they can have some calmness and peacefulness. So there could be many things which attract a person to a spiritual path. So, or a particular path. And the teachings of that particular path may be only one element of that. So with respect to Buddhism, specifically, most people are attracted to Buddhism. Again, I don't want to absolutize, that's why I'm using most, not all. So most people are attracted mainly because of two things. One is the idea of nonviolence and peacefulness. And the second is the idea of compassion and contribution. most people don't really talk too much about the philosophy. And the idea of, okay, everything being, we are all interconnected, there is some kind of ultimate union or something like that. That's not the emphasis. That sounds nice, and that's fine, but that's not what mainly attracts most people. So my understanding would be that when we are trying to interact with a person, with anyone, rather than trying to just put a label, this person belongs to this path, this person is a Buddhist. Because even Buddhism, there are so many different groups and there are different emphasis within the groups. So we'll focus on what is it that person is finding attractive about that path. And we try to see how that connects with Krishna consciousness. So, yes, in terms of philosophy, the idea that the whole universe is interconnected, is whole existence interconnected, that is very much gels with the bhakti philosophy, that everything is ultimately the energy of Krishna. In that sense, we are all interconnected. That is true. Now, the idea of non-self, of the self not being there. Now, in the bhakti tradition, or in general in the spiritual devotional traditions, see, there is the idea of the dissolution of the self, and there is the absorption of the self. And in one sense, both are similar. In another sense, they are extremely different. Dissolution is the idea that the self does not exist at all. That we'll come to a state where we will transcend the idea of the self. But in absorption, the idea is that we find such an attractive reality that we forget ourselves. And in the bhakti tradition, that is what is considered the perfection. So is it similar to non-self? Well, the self always exists. But the self, generally when we use the word self, it is associated with fallibility, it's associated with limitations, it's associated with mortality, it is associated with selfishness and other things. None of those are there in that state. So the idea of going beyond the self in terms of going beyond the limitations of the self, that is very much there. But that does not necessarily mean merging or losing our individuality. It means that losing ourselves in such a rich higher reality that our individuality no longer becomes a limitation it does not have any negative effect on us. So if that is the understanding, then this idea of going beyond the self is also compatible with the broad Gita's understanding. Okay? Thank you. Yes, Prabhu.
When you say the broader self and acknowledging the other person's beliefs and feelings, I can, maybe from my point of view, I remember Shruti Dharma Prabhu, who you could say was the epitome of this, actually. He was, ultimately, he was a man for all seasons. He could associate with royalty, the poorest, the less intelligent, the most intelligent. Somehow, he had this capacity within him, empowered capacity, somehow to each person became a person individually.
Beautiful.
And that's what I see as Shruti Dharma, just as an example for those who didn't know him. You can see more about Shruti Dharma on the YouTube if you want to hear what this person is like and how he spoke to both royalty and the pauper, you know. So that's it's really just a statement.
Thank you. In fact, this whole concept which I mentioned here, you know, this I developed in my discussion with Shruti Dharma Prabhu. He told me that here in the outreach, we generally separate the philosophy and the culture. That culturally we can connect with people, even if philosophically we are different. And then I started reading more about it, and I talked with Giriraj Maharaj about it. And then he told me that at one time, this Dr. Mishra, the Mishra Yoga Studio, when Prabhupada had met, with whom Prabhupada had stayed in New York, he came to meet Prabhupada later in the 1970s after ISKCON had been established. And they had a very cordial talk, they had lunch together. And Prabhupada, then after Giriraj Maharaj asked Prabhupada, I thought he's a Mayavadi. And Prabhupada says, yes. He says, philosophically, we argue like anything. But culturally, we are friends. So, this whole idea that people have different dimensions. And then we need to focus on the dimension that we can connect with them, not on the dimension that is different. So, in 1822, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about knowledge in the mode of ignorance. It's a very striking concept. What it means is that normally knowledge is the opposite of ignorance. Normally knowledge removes ignorance. But this is knowledge that reinforces ignorance. Now how does this knowledge reinforce ignorance? Krishna says, Yattu krutsnavat ekasmin karye saktamahetukam. We take one thing and make it into everything. So here one part is the philosophy. But what we do is, this is a person and this is their philosophy. But what we do is, we equate the entire person with just the philosophy. So philosophy is one part of the person. So when we can find out that actually people have multiple dimensions, and some dimensions may disagree, but some dimensions, there are a lot of similarities. So let's focus and work with those similarities. Then we will be, as you said, treat people like persons. Yes, he's an excellent example. Thank you for mentioning that. Hare Krishna. Yes, Ramu.
Hare Krishna. It's a question about the time. So like, let's say I'm talking to someone and I'm trying to help them. Like, I find it sometimes difficult to know how much time I should give. Sometimes it's months, sometimes it's more. And obviously I'm like limited with my compassion. I'm like, oh, they can just go to Aloka. And I'm like, so how do we make sure that we protect ourselves in relation to time, how much time it gives to someone who's trying? They're making progress, but then they're just...
Okay, good question. Actually, good you asked this question. Thank you. So how much time do we give to people? Actually, when we say give time, there are two different meanings over here. There is, one is we give our time, and the second is let them take their time. So I was primarily referring to the second thing, not the first. If a person is not really interested and not reciprocating, then it's not that we have to spend days and hours and a lot of time with them. It is just that sometimes we open the door for Krishna to somebody, and if they don't walk in through the door, sometimes our tendency is slam the door in their face. Why did you come in? No, it's not necessary to do that. Okay, we open the door and then we leave. If they want, they can come in at their time. So yes, we have to be practical. How much time do we have, especially? And there are different forums. So if you are in book distribution and somebody starts talking a different philosophy, that's not the time to give time. At the time, okay, just move on. But then if we are working with a colleague, if we have a relative, if we have a friend, or some person with whom we have a more of a lasting relationship, or we would like to have a lasting relationship, then in that situation, we may have to both give them our time sometimes, but also let them take their time to come to conclusions. So that way, we can keep the door open. And when we spend time with them, it is not just to see whether, what they are doing and how they are practicing Krishna consciousness. It's also Krishna consciousness has two different meanings, or many, but here in this context, two meanings. We could say is, or when we are trying to interact in a Krishna conscious way with others. One could be, we could say, what that person is doing in relationship with Krishna. Oh, this person is not chanting, this person is not reading the Bhagavad Gita, this person is eating this kind of food and all this. This person is doing nothing in relationship with Krishna. Therefore, there's no Krishna consciousness in this relationship. So, Krishna conscious vision this is interpersonal interaction. When we're interacting with people, what does it mean? The other could be what Krishna is doing in this person's life. That means that although that person may not have a relationship with Krishna, Krishna has a relationship with that person. We may turn away from Krishna, but Krishna never turns away from us. So, that means if that person is going through some experiences, what is happening through those experiences? How is that person's understanding evolving? How is that person becoming wiser or just growing in life? And everybody grows and evolves in life. So if we see from that way, then we'll see, okay, this person is moving from here to here. Maybe they're not yet, they're still at a pre-Krishna conscious level. But Krishna is acting in everyone's life. It is not like for Krishna, if you, like ISKCON membership is not a Lakshman Rekha. Krishna cannot go out of it. Krishna is acting only in the life of those who are members of ISKCON. No, Krishna is acting in everyone's life, even in atheist lives. I once gave a class, you know, God does not believe in atheists. You know, that person may be an atheist, but what God says is, your atheism is just superficial. That's a present misconception. You are still my beloved, precious part. And I'm still acting in your life. So that way, in such situations, we can see from that perspective and find out what we can do in our relationship with them to help them on their journey. Okay, thank you. Any of the ladies have any questions? Okay. Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you for your stimulating class. It's sometimes said that when Mahaprabhu preached to the masses, it was Harinam Sankirtan. To the class, it was Vedanta Sutras and the Mayavadis, the Sannyasis. And then he relished rasa with his intimate associates, Ramananda Roy. Now, it seems to me you're kind of maybe classifying it slightly differently, and I'm curious to know why. Are you saying that for Ramananda Roy, that was outreach to the class as well as relishing internally? So yeah, I'm just wondering.
Okay, good question, yeah. So we could say, was it actually outreach? In the sense that Ramananda Roy was already a devotee relishing high mellows of bhakti. Well, yes, we could say that it was not outreach in the technical sense, that it is not that he's converting Ramananda Roy. But still, it is prior to that meeting, at least in the manifested Leela, Mahaprabhu did not know Ramananda Roy. Ramananda Roy did not know Mahaprabhu. It is Sarvam Bhattacharya who told him, go and meet him. And at least in the manifest narrative arc, it was that meeting that was also such a meeting of minds that Ramananda Roy just decided to leave everything and come and be with Mahaprabhu. And he became an intimate associate. So outreach doesn't have to necessarily mean that we have to change people's minds. Sometimes people may have similar minds, but still they need to link with each other. So that is also class. Class in the sense that he was already, when I'm using the word class, I'm seeing it in more in terms of he's already an evolved person. And with that, he's spending time. And by that spending time, so he was already a devotee, Ramananda Roy. But Ramananda Roy, through this meeting, became inspired to become a part of Mahaprabhu's movement, and he contributed to Mahaprabhu's legacy. Okay, thank you. Any last question? So, thank you very much. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Itai Gaur Premanande. Hare Krishna. I have just written a few books. It's 1 minute. I have written a few books which are available outside. So Srila Prabhupada said, write your realizations on the Bhagavad Gita, or write your realizations and study scripture from different perspectives. Also, I have written 4 books on the Gita in the pandemic period from 4 different perspectives. This is the Gita from a rational perspective, following Baldev Vidya Bhushan's commentaries mood. So there are 100 articles with diagrams, like simple diagrams explaining concepts. So if God controls everything, do we really have free will? If the modes do everything, then why are we considered responsible for our actions? So like that, questions are answered. This is Bhagavad Gita Insight. This is relishing Bhagavad Gita. This is more of the Gita from a relational perspective, following Chakravarti Pad's commentary. How the Gita is not just a philosophy, but it is actually an expression of Krishna's love for Arjuna and divinity's love for humanity. So this is the Gita from an applicational perspective, mindful 365 reflection for daily mindfulness. So how to deal with temptations, how to grow through grief, how to be more sensitive and less judgmental in our relationships. So there are about 50 articles like this on different topics, and total 365 articles. And it's the Gita from an inspirational perspective, 365 quotes inspired by the Bhagavad Gita. So all these are available outside. If any of you want, you can have a look at that. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.